Well, we are now kind of officially in the midst of this sermon series on the importance of discomfort. And I've been talking about the fact that God allows his people to be uncomfortable and that this isn't a mistake. I had a fantastically interesting conversation. Many of you will remember a good while ago. We had here at the congregation the president of the Lutheran Church of South Sudan. And as the pastor that was the leader was here and speaking, I had the opportunity to go out with him to lunch. And we were talking about our individual ministries, and I knew that so much had gone wrong for the people of South Sudan. Civil wars, displacement, time in refugee camps, poverty, hunger, disease, death. I mean, you name it, they had faced it. And I wanted to know how we as an American congregation could best be praying for them or thinking about what resources we might bring to bear for their situation. And so I said to him, what's the biggest challenge? What is the thing that you worry most about for your congregations in the Lutheran Church of South Sudan? And he didn't say any of the things I anticipated. He said, the biggest thing that we are worried about is false teaching. And I remember thinking, that's worse than the Civil War. That's worse than starvation. That's worse than the refugee camps. And I said, as much as diplomatically as I could, because of course this is, you know, his experience and I didn't want to dismiss it. I said, is that the worst that you all are facing, considering how many awful things have happened? He says, well, yes, because it doesn't matter how bad the thing is that we face. If we face it with God, we overcome it. But when we consider and think and trust in false teaching, then we fall away from God, and then it doesn't matter what we face. We will not be successful. And I remember thinking just how significant that was. And I said, what's the number one false teaching that you worry about? And I'm knowing that they are there in the midst of the part of the world that I don't think we all necessarily equate with strong Christian values and ties. In fact, at the time, they were largely in Ethiopia, which is a nation that is officially atheist. And he said, oh, by far the biggest struggle that we face is with American prosperity theology. The theology that if you believe in God, God will make you wealthy and handsome and will give you a nice house and will make it so that you have nothing to worry about. And he says, that is the antithesis of the gospel. Jesus repeatedly tells his disciples that when you believe in me, you must follow me by taking up your cross. In what portion of the language of take up your cross and follow me is prosperity implied? If I say to my people, God wants you to be wealthy and happy and rich, and if you're faithful, you will be wealthy and happy and rich, and my people live in refugee camps, what must they believe about themselves? That they're not faithful. Whereas the God that is in the Bible is one that says over and over and over again that faith is perfected in hardship and trial. That we find our deepest faith in the midst of difficulty, and that discomfort is essential. And of course, that's where we are here in this particular section of the sermon series, talking about what makes discomfort essential. And it really is an important thing. Give me the next slide there, if you would. When I was in high school, it seems appropriate, seeing as how we're remembering all of our high school graduates. When I was in high school, I didn't participate in sports. That wasn't my thing. I participated in speech and debate. That should come as no shock to anyone. I've always enjoyed the process of being in front of people and speaking. And I remember as we began learning how to appropriately do speech and debate competitions and tournaments, and to face not just speaking publicly, but being judged and graded and then awarded or not awarded based on a performance, saying to our speech coach, so how do you get over that anxiety? How do you get over that stage fright? How do you get over that feeling of fear when you are facing the judges and speaking, or in front of a large group of people and speaking? I know that in America, for example, it is far more common to be afraid of public speaking than it is to be afraid of heights, spiders, or fire. So most people would rather be falling off a building covered in spiders while on fire than publicly speak. And I remember our speech teacher saying to us, why would you want to get over the feeling you feel when you stand in front of a group of people? Why would you want to get over that? And we said, because it's very unpleasant. It's hard. She says, describe the feeling. And I said, well, you know, your heart beats fast, your mind races, your palms sweat a little bit, you get butterflies in your stomach. She says, okay. Describe to me the feeling of being in love. We're like, well, love is great. Love is marvelous. Love is wonderful. Love is about somebody caring about you and you caring about them. She said, no, that's not the question I asked. The question I asked is, how does it feel when you fall in love? Not what is it like to be in love. What does it feel like when you fall? What are the attributes of that? We said, well, you get butterflies in your stomach. Your heart races. Your mind goes fast, your palms sweat a little bit. She was like, so basically, there's no difference. We're like, well, yeah, the one thing's good and the other thing's bad. She says, why? Why is the one thing good? You're falling in love, that's great. And the other thing's bad? You're standing in front of a group of people, that's awful. She says, a lot of what you have to learn to do is reframe what scares you to understand that it's what motivates you. It's what drives you. It's what pulls you forward. And I'm sure there are people out there who avoid falling in love because of all of the things I just mentioned. They're like, nope, that's not for me. I don't think that sounds good. But most people I know are more than happy to fall in love, even with all of the butterflies in the stomach and the mind racing and the heart beating and the whole nine yards. Discomfort is the engine that drives faith. If you do not have discomfort in your faith will not move forward. If you have only comfort in your faith will stay exactly where it is. Discomfort is the engine. And we as human beings have trained ourselves to think of it as a bad thing because it feels a certain way. But if we learn to reframe how we think about it, because I remember my speech teacher being like, well, you know, when you go into competition, don't you want your mind to race a little bit? Don't you want your heart to beat a little quicker? Don't you want there to be a little extra adrenaline in your bloodstream? It's going to make your mind focus faster. It's going to make you clearer. It's going to make you sharper. It's going to make the judges feel what you're saying more. Just don't get rid of it. Work with it. Use it. Be driven by it. Well, God wants us to do the same thing. And that feeling of discomfort that drives us forward takes a few shapes. I want to talk to you guys today about how it takes the shapes of revelation, refinement, and renewal. And talking about revelation, We're going to talk about three different passages, if you would please. That's Isaiah, Romans, and John. And this is about reframing how we think about discomfort. I want you to think about a ministry you don't do. A ministry you don't do because thinking about doing it makes you feel uncomfortable. Let's pick something that I think makes everybody uncomfortable. Hospitals. Going to visit someone in a hospital and praying for them in that setting. I remember being a new trainee on my internship and having to do my first hospital visits and not being fully prepared for doing that ministry in that space. And I'm being anxious and worried and fearful about, could I say the right things? Would I do the right things? Could I make the right connections? Could I help people with my prayers? What was the right thing to do? Think about a ministry like that, something that you don't want to do because the very thought of doing it makes you uncomfortable. And let's work our way through reframing our expectations, because part of the problem is you have an expectation of God. I have an expectation of God. We all have an expectation of God, and that is that God expects us to get stuff done. God expects us to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. God expects us to put our nose to the grindstone and work really hard, and if we get developed the skills, then we'll get things done. But that is not the biblical expectation that God has of himself or of us when it comes to what God calls us to do. God calls people who are unprepared. God sends people who lack the proper tools. Time and time again, when God is choosing someone to speak for him, the people of the Old Testament in particular, multiples of them, said, "Why would you choose me to speak for you, God? I'm terrible at public speaking." Moses went so far as to tell God, "I have a speech impediment. Why would you pick me?" We don't know what speech impediment Moses had, but he says he had one. See, God doesn't choose us because we are capable. God chooses us because he wants to do something through our lives that is meaningful. And he'll give us the equipment to do it. He'll give us the strength to do it. He'll give us the wisdom to do it. He simply wants us to respond with yes. So if we reframe our expectations of God, we begin to reframe our expectations of ourselves, if you would please. In my job, I've done a number of different ministries. I started out in a small rural parish in Backwoods, West Virginia, with the intention, and this had always been my intention, that I would go into campus ministry at a university. I'd had a very transformative experience with campus ministry, and I had always wanted to be a campus pastor. And so I was doing my first 3 years in the parish because in the ELCA, which I was in at the time, in order to be a campus pastor, you had to do 3 years in the parish. I was like, I'll do my 3 years, and then I'll move to a campus ministry somewhere. And I was in the running for a campus ministry, and I was, I think, everyone largely considered that I would be the next campus pastor at WVU. I was on the board of directors, I was involved in campus ministry, and sort of out of nowhere, my best friend in ministry, who was also applying for the job, who was a highly skilled pastor, got the job ahead of me. I don't feel so bad because he spent most of his career as Bishop of West Virginia, so if I have to say I lost out to anyone, at least I can say I lost out to a bishop. And probably the single smartest person I know on the planet. So Matthew Riegel, if you're out there listening to this, you are a brilliant theologian, and I concede the loss. You won on purpose. That was a good thing. But then I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do with my life, and God gave me another opportunity, a kind of terrifying opportunity, when the bishop that I had at the time, a fellow by the name of Ralph Duncan, was on the phone with me, and we were just having a conversation. And he says to me, he says, "Russ, you went to a church in Huntington, West Virginia when you were there as a student?" I said, "Yes, I did." He says, "Did you go to this particular congregation?" I said, "Yes, I did." He says, "Would you want to go back?" And I said, as the pastor? He says, not quite. He says, this congregation has collapsed. The worst possible things that could happen to a congregation happened to this congregation. Their pastor left the congregation, left the ministry, turned his back on the faith, destroyed the congregation, stole money. It was just awful. And about four-fifths of the congregation have left. There's just a small remainder left. Would you go in as the position was called mission redeveloper? Basically, you were a troubleshooter. They sent you in to a congregation that really probably should close its doors, but might have a chance. And then your job was to revitalize it from the ground up. And they gave me all this training. They sent me to Chicago, went to the national offices, went to the mission redeveloper school, the whole nine yards, and went into this really kind of frightening situation. And I am here in the midst of this frightening situation, and I'll never forget my first time that I sat down with the church council. And we talked about what our plans for the future might be. And they were very clear. They wanted to fix things. They wanted to bring people back. They wanted to get their pews full again on a Sunday. They wanted the ministries that they did to be revitalized. They wanted to be an active community again, with one caveat. They wanted everything fixed as long as they didn't change anything. And I remember thinking, wait, you want me to fix everything that's broken as long as I don't change anything? Everything's broken. Is it the whole point that I'm going to change it all? Like, if I don't change anything, that means everything stays broken. In today's Old Testament lesson, God is speaking to the people of Israel through a prophet. And the prophet is saying, God is going to show you a new thing. God is actually going to show them a new thing while they're in the Babylonian captivity. Not a comfortable situation by any stretch of the imagination. But God needs to show them a new thing because they've turned their back on God. They're broken. They need fixed. They don't want to be changed, but God is like, if I'm going to fix you, I'm going to change you, because if you're broken, I can't fix you without changing you, because that's the way this works. And you'll notice that not all change is growth. Some change is you've actually gone backwards, but all growth is change. There's no way to move forward and remain as you were. And for Israel, they move forward in their faith and their commitment to God, but not as they were. They have to change to do it. God reveals to us in the midst of trial and in the midst of discomfort those things that need to be changed about ourselves, about our faith, about our relationship with Him. God is always changing His people. God doesn't change Himself, but He changes us. We don't always like that process. In fact, oftentimes we really don't like that process. As Paul is writing to the church in Rome, if you would please, Rome is going through a difficult time. What has happened in the city of Rome is that the Christian church was founded by the Jewish believers, and they built up the faith of Rome, and they brought in all of these Gentile believers, and the Church of Rome has grown. And then a really bad thing happened, and it happens to the people of Israel on a regular basis. The government decided to blame the Jews for whatever was going wrong. It's a theme. It happens to them a lot. God bless the poor people. That is something that happens again and again. And so Rome decides they're going to kick out all the Jews. And they do. They exile all of the Jews, and that includes the Jewish Christians. And that leaves the Gentile Christians to run the Christian church in Rome. And they do. And they begin to build it back up again. And it begins to become stronger and stronger and stronger. And then Rome says, yeah, we were wrong. It wasn't the Jews' fault after all. So they let all the Jews come home. And the Jewish Christians come home too. And the Jewish Christians come home to the ministry that they were doing. And there's people in their jobs. There's Gentile Christians leading the church. And you know what? The Jewish Christians come back and go, we're back, we're in charge again. And the Gentile Christians go, why? We've done just fine without you, thank you very much. you can do these other jobs that are left over. And there is now this enormous conflict in the church in Rome. Who gets to do what? Who's in charge? And they are fighting and they are struggling. Now not just with the Romans, but with each other. And it's a very uncomfortable and difficult time. To which Paul writes his letter. A letter which is largely considered to be the single greatest work, a masterwork of Christian theology, on which we form almost everything that we understand about how to properly do church. And he begins to teach them in the midst of this conflict, in the midst of this trial, these difficult times, being persecuted by the Romans, that this is a crucible. This is a refining process when we figure out what actually matters. Paul says to the folks in Rome, look, I know you think it matters that you're Jewish or you're Gentile, you were here, you were not here. None of that matters. What matters is that you love God, you serve God, you believe in God, and you are here for the gospel of Jesus Christ. Don't ask yourself, what's in it for me? Refine what you understand matters and it is important. When God gives us discomfort, it's partially for us to say, what really matters to me? What is really important to me? Where in my faith can I find that thing that strengthens me up? And are a lot of the things that I value in life actually just a waste? Because they do not build the only thing that matters up, which is my relationship with God, which comes back exactly to what I was talking about with the president of the Lutheran Church of South Sudan. He wanted his people to come through this crucible and be refined into a people who understand that what matters most in the world isn't physical possessions, isn't even having a roof over your head. That at the end of the day, what matters most is having faith that God is with us, gives us strength, direction, hope, and will bring us through what we are facing. And when we have that, next slide, please. That's when we get to the point of renewal. Renewal comes when we understand that we have been through this process for a reason, and that God has made use of it. He has shown us something new about ourselves, about our relationship with Him. He has refined away, burnt away all the things that don't matter, down to the elements of faith that really do drive us forward. And in doing so, we are now given new hope. Have you ever had the opportunity to look through the website that the Lutheran Church of South Sudan has? There's one thing that I always find most amazing, because that pastor brought a slideshow with him. And I've noticed this a lot in the photos of people in the refugee camps. They're all smiling. Not just the smile that you put on when somebody says, I'm going to take your photo. You know, because I'll admit I'm terrible at that smile. You know, I never quite know what I'm supposed to do with my face. You know, I have great respect for professionals who can just look at a camera and have a smile. And people, oh, that smile's so great. You know, no, I'm always, people are always like, your eyes are squinty. I'm like, I know my eyes are just squinty, but I can't fix that. No, these people have the look of somebody who's filled with joy and happiness. Really genuinely happy. And this is despite the fact that everything that the world would proclaim should make them happy, they don't have. But the one thing that truly matters, they have in enormous abundance. And that is faith. So ladies and gentlemen, we're gonna keep talking our way through this as we go. We're going to talk about why discomfort is this great and driving force. I look forward to getting deeper into this with you all, but I say to you today, find those places in life where you are uncomfortable. Find those places in life where you have discomfort. and celebrate them because they matter. They are important. It is the engine that will drive you forward. Amen.